Hello and welcome to the Indie Dev Podcast. I'm your host, David Voiles, and this week I'm joined by Ethan Lee. Ethan is a software engineer based out of Georgia who has a history of working on what is previously XNA, but is now his own open source fork of the project. Along the way, he has ported a countless number of titles for independent developers across a broad spectrum of platforms, including PC, Mac, and Linux. Ethan, thank you for joining us.
Really good to be here.
So you have the portfolio here. So I've been following along with what you've been doing for a long time because I was involved with the XNA community several years ago. So before we dive into that, can you explain to users what XNA is? And then we'll go from there.
XNA was basically, from what I can gather, because I actually was not, I've shipped about 36 ports so far. I think 22, 23 of those are XNA games. Okay. And I've never actually shipped an XNA game myself. It happened to be that someone gave me an XNA game and I just figured out, what do I got to do to make it work somewhere else? And from what I can gather, XNA was basically this weird experiment internally at Microsoft to see if they could take C#, which is one of their hot things of the time,
yep,
and make some like little monolithic toolkit so that people could ship just like DirectX type things, but they didn't want to make just DirectX Sharp, basically.
Right.
And then they managed, I guess at the same time, this is when the 360 was starting to roll up its digital market, and so I guess they decided to make, like, basically what ended up being XBLIG. That's what I can gather about it. And so that went on for, I think like the first versions that came out were like 2006, 2007?
Yes, March 14th, 2006 was the first version.
Ah, okay. So, yeah, and then that went on until about 2010, and then XBLIG kept going, but the XNA development side was getting quiet, and then finally, right, like 3 years later, they went, yeah, we kind of stopped working on it.
Yeah, it was one of those things they kind of looked back in hindsight and said, oh, yeah, we stopped a while ago.
Yeah, whoops. But the funny thing is, like, by the time that had been kind of formally announced, people had been making their own implementations for whatever purpose. For the original version, I think there was like a thing called XNA Touch in 2009.
Oh, wow.
That was basically someone trying to get their really basic XNA game on iOS. That's what I can gather. And then out of that came mono.xna, which was an attempt to get XNA stuff on like just other platforms. And then from that became Mono Game, which is the thing that's now out there, which is like, they're technically there's like OpenGL-ish stuff, but the core of the development ended up being towards like Windows RT or the Windows RT API. And so my role in that was I went into the Monogame project with the advertisement of Windows, Mac, and Linux support. Yep. Notice that none of that was really true. Yeah. And so I ended up over the course of about 6 months, I ended up going and doing almost a total rewrite of the platform API to get a game called Capsized out for Mac and Linux. Yes. A lot of it was they used this library called OpenTK.
Yep.
And by the end of the second month of development, myself and a colleague of mine, David Gao, had taken it apart separately to assess to see what we could do to fix it. And both of us came to the conclusion that it was not fixable. So
just forget this and let's move on.
We in the beginning of April of 2013, we made a C# wrapper for SDL2. It took us about a week, and then a week later I had an OpenGL bindings, another week later I had OpenAL bindings, and by the end of April I had a far superior version of Capsized for Linux running with a completely different rewrite. So
this is with the graphics library and the audio library completely rewritten?
Surprisingly, it was just the platform layer. There's just some changes to like the GL renderer and the ALs for like exact implementation type things, but for the most part it was just the platform. But then what happened is that I shipped that, and then word got around that someone made a version of, I swear to God this is true, someone advertised it as the version of Monogame that works. And so I started getting so many emails from, like, I think that was, because my first game for that was an XNA port shipped in May. No, it was the very end of May of 2013.
Okay, and which game was that?
That was Capsized. And then in the very end of May in 2014, Towerfall, my 15th XNA port went out.
Wow, holy cow.
So as soon as people got word that there was a version of Monogame that worked, in their words, not necessarily mine,
right.
Everybody was sending me emails. Yeah. So then from there, since there were so many games and so many of them had so many different needs, that's mm-hmm. when the rewrite of the graphics system came in, the rewrite of the audio subsystem, and then there was a point where I said, oh crap, I've rewritten most of this library. I should probably rename it.
Yeah, yeah. So that's where you got the idea to start FNA from there.
Yes.
Gotcha. Yeah, because I was curious as to how they kind of diverged and where that fork came from. So that makes sense now.
Yeah. And it's the funny thing is we share a lot of, like, when it comes to, like, research of how the binary formats work, we definitely share a lot of info, myself and Sickhead Games, who do a lot of
So Tom Spillman and those folks over there.
Yeah, like they do a lot of PS4 versions of games that I also do Linux and Mac versions on. So we end up looking at a lot of the same data.
Yeah,
I bet. If one of us can get to it first, then we just put it in the pool, and then we can kind of figure out how to make both of the libraries better for XNA accuracy.
Yep.
Even if the two libraries are different in that FNA is just trying to be XNA 4 as much as possible, whereas right. Monogame is looking to be XNA 5.
Gotcha. Okay, that's a very clear understanding of what happened then.
Yeah. Because I think once like Direct3D 12 and Vulkan start getting actual yep. use, that's when they're gonna have to break the API to make that work.
Right, because XNA was stopped at DirectX 9, correct?
The funny thing is they stopped at DirectX 9, but the API is written like 10.
Ah, okay.
So it's like they pre-gamed the idea that they would add Direct3D 10 support,
but
it died before they could do it.
Yeah.
So it's this really awkward situation where we have to write to this Direct3D 10 API, but it actually works very much to the detriment of the actual API being used because there's so much caching going on and state shadowing. And a lot of this is very apparent if you look at the source of both Monogame and FNA. There's just all this cludging of binary, like pipeline state objects, and trying to do it as traditional render states. That might be a little bit less horrible when you get into things like Direct3D 12 and Vulkan, but
okay.
It's a lot of fun to try and untangle it.
So now, Vulkan, as far as I understood, that was AMD's attempt at their own graphics library.
It started out as an explicit API called Mantle, which AMD.
That's what I was thinking of. They had like a scene where there's like a bunch of spaceships like shooting. That was like how I first got introduced to it a couple years ago.
It was basically there was an engineer at DICE who was tired of Direct3D 11 and especially like even modern GL, and so I guess somehow DICE and AMD got this deal together, and he basically designed an API that did not really get used past like Battlefield 3,
I think.
And then because like nobody wanted to ship for one GPU, so
yeah, seriously.
And like, so
I mean, if we learned anything from the Voodoo and Glide days, right?
Oh yeah. So I think the result was that people liked, like, my understanding is that all the AAA devs, they loved the idea of Mantle, but they didn't want to ship that. And then once
it's one more thing to have to write for.
Yeah, and so I think like basically like a couple years later, that's when Valve started doing Linux support for their games.
Yep.
And so they were kind of dealing with OpenGL and all of its kludge, and then as they were trying to get stuff on their Source 2 engine, it became very apparent between them and DICE and the Unreal guys that explicit APIs really need to be made a standard.
Yes.
So that's when everybody started. That's when everybody magically started joining Cronus Group, and now we
Yeah, I noticed that too
in the pipeline. So now we're looking at Vulkan. I hope it's soon. The deadline was like a month ago, but I guess they missed that. So
now, can you explain quickly what the Cronus Group is?
The Cronus Group is basically a board. It's almost, I almost want to call it like a board of directors that makes various APIs like standards.
Yep.
Because I want to say the APIs often come first, because even with OpenGL, that was something by like SGI or something like that in the 90s, and then they made it an open standard.
So that's Silicon Graphics, right?
Yes.
Yep.
And then now we have a situation where AMD came up with this thing in collaboration with DICE, and now that's being made into an open standard. So a lot of it's really just establishing like a reference manual for what a standard should look like, and then that's where the vendors like AMD, NVIDIA, all the mobile graphics vendors, I can't list them all, like that's when they start to implement something on top, like based around that API, and they can extend it however they need to. But the understanding is that when you have like the standard that you write to as the application developer, it should, for the most part,
just work everywhere.
Everywhere. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the web development community, we're seeing that finally work the way it was initially intended. Because we had plugins all the time and nothing worked, and IE 6, 7, and 8 were horrendous. And now, you know, the plugin model is going away and everyone's going towards HTML5 standard. So if you write it once, it should work everywhere and it's getting better. But, you know, we're seeing the same thing in the graphics community too, which again is extremely important for the web because the Kronos group is also responsible for WebGL, right? The web implementation of the OpenGL library.
Yeah, it's basically like a small subset so that browser vendors don't have to kill themselves trying to go through every single GL extension, and there are way too many, which is another reason why Vulkan is coming out, because the extension library is massive.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, get one thing, it's piled on top of another and another. So like, what's interesting about this episode we have is this is definitely one of the more technical, if not the most technical ones we've had yet. So like, you and I clearly have an understanding of what's happening here, but I think a lot of developers, at least recently, don't quite understand how graphics or graphics libraries work with the introduction of middleware, right? So we have things like Unreal Engine and Unity, which are great, and I use them both heavily. Hell, I wrote a book on the Unreal Engine, so I love the tools. But like, what do you think? Is it imperative or essential for developers to understand how graphics work to make great games? And if so, why or why not?
It's definitely going to get a it gets more, it's not just it's, I could say that it's essential now, mm-hmm. but what's more important is that it becomes more essential over time because games are way too complicated.
Yes.
If you compare, if you like go into Quake GL or like GL Quake, like the source to
someone's
the
actually
Quake.
Actually doing this right now. Funny.
Oh really?
That. Yeah, he's God, I had it in like my weekly newsletter last week. But essentially he's going through the Quake source code in an attempt to teach people how it works. I'll send you the link after this and I'll put it in the show notes. But I ran into it and I was like, wow, this is incredible. So he's diving into all the C, showing people how to recompile it, and like stepping through every line of the code to illustrate, you know, how these things worked back then and what we can learn from it today.
Yeah, and like even Quake 2, like, which is one of the I love Quake 2 CTF.
Yeah. Right, and had like software rendering support, hardware rendering.
Yeah, it was great because they like they split out the render into like a DLL, so you could just write your own custom render for it. But like, if you look at the GL for Quake 1 and 2, like because the thing is, I learned OpenGL basically by doing like, because back then I only sort of knew Java, and so what happened was like, in order to learn how to do games, because I was a musician for my whole life.
Yeah, so like, we'll come back to that in a minute because like I want to pick your mind about how you even get started into this.
Yeah, it's a weird story, but you know, you look at the Quake 1 and 2 renders, you know, they did some crazy stuff even back then, but if you look at the GL code, it's not that bad. You can parse through it pretty quickly, but if you compare that to, say, God, look at Doom 3 BFG, like that's like an updated version of a game from 10 years ago, and it's
right,
insane.
And they went through it like 2 years ago, yeah, for the update.
Yeah, and because a lot of that came from IdTech 5 that just kind of stapled to the old Doom 3 stuff. But like, and that's with a high level API. And the interest now is that we want more explicit ones. Yeah. And I'm interested in seeing how many lines FNA's Vulkan device will be, if I can even do it. Because right now the GL device is, I think it's 5,000 lines.
Okay.
I'm expecting Vulkan to be at least 3 times larger than that.
So that'll keep you busy for a little while, huh?
Yes, that's going to be... And that's also excluding the shader recompiler, which also I need to make for Spear V, and that's going to be massive as well.
Jeez. Yeah, so you've got your hands full for a bit.
Yeah, and most engine vendors have their hands full as well. Like, I don't even know if Unity has that in progress yet.
Like, or you look at, like, all the 3D technologies that are coming out, right? Like, so 3D I'm somewhat familiar with, but not nearly as familiar as I am with, like, graphics libraries. Is there a standard? And by that I mean, because I still look at 3D as a very niche product for the next several years.
Yeah.
I mean, if I write an application in something like Unity, from what I understand, they're kind of abstracting everything away, so it's really just like, you know, a 3D an object you attach to your camera, and then they'll say, hey, we'll handle 3D for you. Is it like that across the board? I mean, are the 3D manufacturers and vendors working on a standard library, or how does that work?
They're starting to, mostly by force, because they're way too, because it kind of reminds me of like the really old days of like the PC where there's the Commodore, there's the Commodore Amiga, like 64, like so many different machines. And right now VR is in a state where we were about to start doing that again, but because VR is extremely hard and extremely niche, everybody's like, wait, maybe we should think this through.
Yeah, seriously.
And so, like, we have things like 3D vision from NVIDIA, and like, that's just 3D, and then you compare it to, like, the VR libraries. And right now, we're now getting to the point where Oculus actually helped contribute to an OpenGL extension for example, doing two viewports with one rendering pass instead of two, because you have to technically render for both eyeballs.
Yeah.
So there's things like that showing up.
A huge offload from your GPU, drawing it once instead of twice.
Yeah, and so there's things like that showing up. I don't know how, because I don't want to know how much is changing the back end when it comes to what's the correct way to do VR, because I assume, because I have like a DK1 in my closet, and I'm assuming if I were to look at the SDKs from that compared to the shipping version, I'm
drastically different.
Yeah, and so I'm assuming that's going to keep happening, because I'm sure even the consumer Oculus Rift is drastically different from Gear VR. So, and Gear VR was something from last year.
Yes, I mean, it's just going to keep changing and changing and changing.
And so there's going to be a point where someone's going to finally just say, I don't want to ship for 30,000 of these, and there's got to be a right answer somewhere, so let's try and do it once and not 600 times, all with different SDKs and libraries you have to load or link to. And I'm just glad I don't have to do any VR work, because I let somebody else do that.
And say dynamic and dynamic targets, what's consistently changing.
Yes, definitely.
That's going to be tough for the next few years. So how did you get started in all of this? Because it's obviously a very technical skill you have. Did you go to school for computer science? Like, what piqued your interest in all of this?
I went to school for music production.
Oh, wow, very different world.
So I was a musician in high school. I was actually at one point a music teacher. I was teaching like middle and high school band, like concert band, and sometimes like, like music theory classes. And then when I went to college, I went to production for the intention of doing game audio.
Okay. So you've always been a fan of video games then?
Oh yeah, definitely. For a very long time. But there was a point where, because I think a lot of college students think this, and this is, it's hard for me to give this as advice, but give this as an example of how I got out of that mindset where you're like 3 years in and you're like, I still don't know anything. Like and I have like nothing to show for the fact that I know nothing. And so in like 2011, that was the year that Minecraft won every award ever.
Yeah, basically. They just completely cleaned the house.
They swept the industry as a whole. Yeah. But that was all in Java. And I had actually, the only prior programming I had to 2011 was a single class in Java, which was literally like system.out.println x plus y.
Right. It's like that's the how little basic I knew. Stuff.
And so I was like, all right, it's just, instead of printing to the console, it's printing to the screen. I guess I'll learn OpenGL with, back then it was the lightweight Java game library, which is still pretty good. And over the course of like a year or so, I basically made this like tiny little tech demo almost solely in service of doing something for game audio. So it wasn't really that I was learning to program because I was interested in being an engineer. It was just like I needed to literally make something that I could put audio in and then I could focus on the audio.
I think that's how a lot of engineers get started too, right? They're making their own tools, which are helpful for other people later on.
Yeah, and that's the way I learned to do everything I did. It was strictly I needed to do some kind of data transformation, so I'm going to write that, as opposed to a lot of the like diagramming and a lot of like people will show me stuff that they do like at the final year of university. I'm like, where's the code? All I see are diagrams. Where's the code?
Yeah.
And so then about a year in, I had like it was a very unfun, but at least somewhat technically interesting demo with audio. And that's how I got the first contract for Waveform, which is a game that shipped in 2012. And so I was going to do audio tech for that game. Like I was going to do like you would read a WAV file in and then it would create levels based on the track, sort of like Audio Surf or something like that.
Okay, right. That's the gist that I got just from seeing the screenshot on your portfolio page.
Yeah. And so I was going to do that. But the problem is it was Windows only. And in late 2010, I had actually switched to Linux by that point. And so I was like,
that's what you use now is Linux.
Yes. That's my primary. It's almost all of my development experiences on
Holy
Linux.
Holy cow.
And so I was like, part of my logic when I was originally negotiating the contract was I'm just going to make a Linux version in private and then just make the audio tech and hope he doesn't notice.
Yeah.
But then once I kind of admitted that that's what I was going to do.
Okay.
He was like, why don't we just sell that then? And so I went, all right, I guess I can make a Linux and a Mac version.
Yeah.
We'll ignore the fact that I didn't have a Mac until like December of that year.
Oh, man. Yeah, I use a Mac too, so I can kind of see what everyone else is doing in the real world. That's actually where I'm recording this from.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And so I ended up making the Mac version. And then coincidentally, like literally the month that I started my first contract is when Valve announced Linux support for their stuff.
Right.
So,
and which like has been their huge push largely due to this Steam OS.
Yes. And so when that, like those two things combined, the fact that there was this new Linux porter on the scene, combined with Valve now making this push on top of Humble's previous push, that's when
you just found yourself in a nice job market.
I was like, I thought it was like, to me, like, I think I even wrote in my original post that it was just going to be like a summer job. And then suddenly I have like emails from Humble saying, hey, we have like six games we want you to work on.
Yeah. And you're like, well, okay, I guess I have a new job.
And that, well, the funny thing is, remember, I'm still in college being a college, some dumb student not doing anything. But I remember like in August, like after Waveform shipped, after I had Eversion coming out really soon, and then a bunch of Humble contracts with these numbers, like I didn't know you could have that many zeros at the end of that number. Yeah. But
you realize that programming is a pretty lucrative job at times,
especially when you're previously used to being a musician where you're like, all right, $20 a night.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, like, usually, like, the joke is, right, if you're a programmer, you can make a good living, but in games, like, most people are barely getting by and are struggling, but that's largely due to the crazy marketplaces. So you found yourself in a nice spot, but it was because it was largely in a very in-demand market at the right time.
Yes. And so basically I just remember sitting, like, I was like with my mom in like beginning of August, and like, we were like silent for a little while, and then she finally turned to me and said, are you really gonna go back to school in the fall? And I went, oh wait, did she just say that?
Yeah, she's like, you'd be silly at this point to do it.
And so I was like, so then that's when I started working on things like Vessel and Capsized, and that's when, at the time, really I actually, my first few projects actually, either they didn't sell well, even though they were good, or they were genuinely, like, Vessel is probably the one that, it took a really long time, and it didn't even turn out that great anyway. Mm-hmm. So I was sort of wondering where I was going to be in the next year, because, like, I wasn't going to go back to school either way.
Oh, I remember Vessel now. So I'm looking at the screenshot. I didn't quite remember it, but now that yeah, I know exactly what this game is about.
Yeah.
It's very much like a puzzle-based thing.
Yeah, you manipulate like the liquid physics to solve puzzles. But then that's when the Monogame stuff started coming in. And then once that took off and ended up becoming FNA, that's when I kind of re-secured my job security, because I basically have 100% of the market for XNA games on Mac and Linux. Like, I don't. Because even though Monogame technically advertises it, the fact is FNA is the one where it always worked, because right now the Monogame team, when reevaluating their desktop platform, they're now doing things that I did 3 years ago.
Yeah.
So now I'm
They seem to be very focused on like PS4 and consoles at this point.
Yes. And so
they have like a massive market there too. So it's interesting. You two have kind of like diced up the market in two very separate ways.
Yeah. It's kind of been fun because they work on, it's interesting how we ended up having completely opposite platforms, where Monogame was on WinRT and console, where I was everywhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and you see, like, more people are playing games, you know, by the day, so it just opens up new opportunities for both of you.
Yeah, definitely. And it's been very interesting, because I was not an XNA or even a C# developer. Like, just empirically, when I was figuring out how to do lots of programming, like, the language that I clung to the most was C.
Ah, okay. Yeah, so you have a very good understanding of the lower level ways that things are working then.
Yeah, like I'm very much data oriented rather than object oriented. So when I spend a lot of time,
I saw your tweet recently that I just sent that back out about what OOP claims or users claim and what it actually happens, and that is the absolute truth.
Yeah, and so like I spend a lot of time just, you'll see a lot of comments or commits with my name on them that basically say C# is dumb and I hate and I just hate life.
Like there's parts about it that clearly frustrate you.
Most of it does, especially the runtime, because I'm like, I spend a lot of time fighting runtimes and things that I normally would just be like, I can just compile. Like, I mean, there are some things that I've made good out of the C# environment, which is like, I can compile on a single machine and then ship it wherever I want. So like,
wow, that's awesome.
So even though I technically am a Linux and Mac developer, even with native code, I do almost no development on the Mac. And that includes my Windows versions as well, where it's like I never actually develop on either of those two platforms. All of my development happens on Linux.
Wow, and like you never have a hard time finding tools or the things that you need?
Nope, because either they're tools that I wrote and I just have a... Like, I have a real... The thing about multi-platform development is that people think that it's writing three times. It's really just writing once correctly.
Right.
And so, and it's because there is an element of write once, run anywhere that people try to say that where
you want the silver bullet everywhere, but good luck.
That's not true. But like, but if you know, if like once you get used to the habits, you can develop your own sort of like reflect. Like a lot of the portability things I do, people look at it and be like, "How did you know to do that?" And I'm like, "I don't know. I've just done it like 30 times."
Yes, so like ingrained in your head after a while.
Yeah, like I like people will send me like the most cryptic exception messages ever, and I'm like, oh, I've seen this before. Just do this,
and they're like, I can't Google this. There's no Stack Overflow answer for it.
Yeah, and so they're like, no, I've seen it. Just do this, and they're like, how did you like what? Why?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, and like you're right. Cryptic response codes or error messages. That is like the bane of every developer's existence.
Yeah,
because right, throw it in Google and hope for the best, and then who knows what you're going to end up getting out sometimes.
Yeah, and so a lot of what I do in FNA is like, it's funny because people will make fun of my error messages or my printfs, but the fact is they're way more clear than any error code you typically get in a library.
Right, and it's probably not just like, you know, some absurd, you know, string of characters together, and you're like, well, until I can find a developer who knows what this means, I'm kind of out of luck.
And especially if you just do it in plain English, like one of the things that we have in FNA's exact reimplementation is we technically don't have.
That's the audio tool, correct?
Yes. Technically, we have support for like PCM, and I actually wrote an extension to OpenAL Soft call for MS-80 PCM support. So we have 80 PCM support as well, but the one that we don't have is XMA or XWMA because I have no idea how the formats work, and so I. Mm-hmm. That technically the correct way to handle that is to throw a not supported exception that says, you know, XMA not supported.
Yep.
Whereas the real error message should be rebuild your wavebank with 80 PCM. Like right. I just straight up say that. Like
yeah,
just
right.
rebuild it.
Okay, I know what the issue is, but you've also given me a solution as to how to resolve this.
Yes. And so that's the one thing I hate the most about error messages is that they just say what's wrong, even though for you to know what's wrong, you have to know what to do right so that you don't get that error.
Right.
So it's interesting how, like, I'm not, even in my own head, like, day to day, I'm not really that much of a programmer. There's the music stuff still sort of the main thing in the front of my head. A lot of the really ugly engineering's at the back of my head.
Yep.
And yet, with only, like, 4 or 5 years of programming experience, I feel like I've had 20 based on what people who are way older, way more experienced will write.
Yeah,
and I don't know why.
No, I agree. I mean, you and I essentially started programming at the same time because 2011 was when I started as well. But like looking at where you are, and then my job is to, you know, work with startups and developers across the U.S., you're years ahead of most people, and especially people who have, you know, a decade of experience. So, yeah, really surprised to see how far you've come such a short period of time, because I would have never guessed.
Me neither. I thought programming was supposed to be like, I mean, it's hard, but
yeah,
I'm surprised at just how much work goes into doing the wrong thing when it's harder anyway.
Yeah, it's like just here's a dumb, easy solution, get it in there, and we'll worry about it later on, which becomes technical debt for somebody else.
And the funny thing is, it's not even a matter of, like, we have to deal with it later. Like, one of the really big things that makes FNA appealing, especially on Linux, is that our dependency tree is good.
Yep.
Like, and it's really easy to do an easy dependency tree. Like, it's really simple. It's like you link to SDL, you link to OpenAL, and maybe like Vorbis. And that's only if you need it.
Yeah.
But like, when I do support for games other than that, and they have a dependency on GDI plus.
Yeah.
Like, I actually have, like, in my MagFest slides, I just have a slide that has the dependency list for GDI plus because it's hysterical. Mm-hmm. There, it links to two versions of PNG. I'm not making that up. Like, and
they're trying to make it as difficult as possible for you.
And so I'm like, look, it's so easy to replace this. It's literally just an image loading library. Use like SDL image, or use like the numerous like C#, pure C#, like PNG, JPEG, etc. loaders. And it, yep. Like, no dependencies, multi-platform, nothing to worry about. And I even give it, I like spoon feed it to them. Like, I've written the replacement. Here it is.
Right.
And they will still ship the crappy thing. And I'm like, just,
some people don't get it.
And so I'm like, that's the part where I, as a software developer, I just have to be willing, despite my personality, I just have to be willing to say, I absolutely trust no developer unless I have explicit documented proof that they have something in their head that somebody in the scientific community might say, in if they were to model it, resembles something that might be a neuron. Like, I just need to be able to say, look, I have a million reasons to not trust you.
Right.
Here's the right thing to do. If you do it wrong, that's your fault. And now I'm going to make fun of you for it.
And especially because so many people write code in very different or very distinct ways, right? Some people will comment, some people will not. At my previous job, I was working on a small project, and I got in there about 2 months into the project, and they had hundreds of functions, and many of them had no comments. This is JavaScript at the time. And one of the functions, you know what that's like. And especially without comments, one of the functions accepted 12 parameters, but I had no idea of what the type was. It was just the name of the parameter. And basically you would draw an empty HTML page, and if you filled in the parameters, it would make this whole video on demand catalog. And it took me like 3 days to debug this one, what the issue was, because this one function would generate the rest of the code for us. And it's because they didn't comment or document anything. So one person made one spelling error on one line of code, and it broke the whole project. But because there was just really no standard they were kind of adhering to and absolutely no comments, it made it impossible for anyone to understand what was going on.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can feel your pain. It's frustrating at times.
And so it's like, the thing is, like, it also, you have to be able to recognize that there are people who live in the editor and the debugger. And if you make either of those two miserable, then you're going to have a really bad project.
That's right.
Because I just use whatever text editor I want. If someone asked me what text editor to use, I'd have to look. Like, I'd have to check.
Like, what's the first thing that opens when I double click on that text file?
Yeah. And so compare that to the debugger, where I have a slew of debugging tools and I can give you an exact order and role for every single one.
Yeah.
And when I have to use something like Boost or any of the templated standard template libraries or anything like that, I will spend, like, I make a joke that there are things that if I look in the source code for anything and I find even a single instance of any of those things, I double the price of my contract. Like, if there's threads, I'm already worried.
Yeah, because a lot of people will use them but not understand why to use them or how, right? So threading is a gift and a curse.
Threading's just a curse. I have very little evidence that it's a gift in any way other than, like, there's one thread in FNA, and the only reason we have it is because we have to simulate what Windows Media Player does. So that's, like, even the good case, you're simulating a bad case.
Yeah.
You have to be like Windows Media Player, which you never want to be like.
Yeah, and it's interesting you have this remark about threads, because that's a common issue when I give talks on JavaScript. People say, oh, well, it's single-threaded. So, well, give me a practical example of where you've seen great threads written and it worked correctly. And then all of a sudden they're like,
Like
a shortcoming.
Not only that, but the case where a great threading sample exists is a superior single-threaded model.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a ton of my contracts, what happens is I see something that's multi-threaded, and after, you know, having whatever drinks are necessary, I go in and I will make a single-threaded version, and it will be faster every time.
Yeah.
Every single time. So, like, I remember when I was dealing with Fez, he had some threaded GL in there, because that's actually sort of what Monogame allowed you to do, but it did it really slowly.
Right.
And even the fast way of doing it is also really slow. So I basically went, okay, I kind of snuck around his code, and I went, I'm going to take my version of the threading model, and then I'm going to make it single-threaded. And then I showed that to him, and he was, like, panicking to me, like, dude, what if it's so much slower? And I'm like, dude, it's faster on every single machine I have.
Yeah.
And that's actually what ships today.
We all learn a little something.
Yep.
That's like, good.
Like, and so I think what makes me a fat, like, I'm not about to say that I'm on the scale of like Sean Barrett or Casey Muratori or any of those really,
Casey
smart
has
guys.
Fantastic YouTube channel, by the way, if you want to learn how to. Yeah, Handmade Hero. He just had Handmade Hero Con in Seattle a couple weeks ago. If you want to learn graphics, how to make a game from scratch, I would encourage anybody to take a look at this. It's Handmade Hero. He has a YouTube channel and a Patreon and everything. But
I consider it a requirement, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I learned so much from watching like random parts of his videos. He just had one on how the GPU works the other day and key differences between the CPU and GPU. And he is one of the greatest teachers I've ever come across. So, yeah, he's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, he's been doing it since he was like a kid. So, and he's always been very insistent on the machine because he's one of the guys that shows up. Yeah, he does some stuff with Rad, and you know, when you think about,
he was working at Rad Tools for a while, right?
Yeah, like he's done stuff like Granny, and he's also helped with like Bink, and I think he's done some help on their debugger, which I'm kind of hype about. But the fact is, like, those guys are really smart.
Yeah.
But it's possible to be skilled, but you have to be able to figure out what makes you makes you better at it as quickly as possible. And for me, instead of taking the academic route, I insist with people that what I do is a trade, not an academic or even scientific endeavor.
Yep.
It is very, I consider it on the same level as painting houses. Mm. Like, you got to get good at it by doing it and knowing exactly what's happening, what's the actual data, what's the actual result you're supposed to get, and what is the actual way that you can do it in an optimal manner. So like, I don't live in a vacuum. Like,
right. Yeah. So, well, you're in the Atlanta area, right?
Yeah, I'm in Atlanta now. I moved here last August. So.
Oh, okay. So you're not originally from there then?
I'm from Baltimore. So.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm in Philadelphia now, but spent a lot of time down in Atlanta, but they have, like quite the tech scene over there, between the CDC, TNT, Adult Swim games. Like, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, my fiance is actually at the CDC. That's why we're here. And then when I was looking around, I noticed like there's Adult Swim. And then somebody mentioned CCP to me because they're a huge Eve fan.
Oh yeah, I actually had a meeting with them about 2 months ago.
Really?
In Atlanta. Yeah. I always forget because they have like their VR and research lab down there. It's like only a handful of developers, but have you come across it before?
I've not really spoken with anyone here just yet because I think I had something like 6 titles for the last half of the year. Or no, it was like something like 6 or 7 or 8. So I kind of lose count after a while.
So you did have to live in a bubble for that brief period of time.
The funny thing is I kind of have the missus drag me out. So.
Yeah.
And then there's like Tripwire that.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right.
And so there's like a few guys here. It's about the same as Baltimore where you have like Bethesda and Firaxis and I think there's a branch of Stardock that's there. I don't remember.
Yeah, so see, the East Coast is not, incredibly desolate for games. We have something. So you don't all have to move to the Bay Area, L.A., or Seattle.
It used to be a lot bigger, too, because I think I think Grant Kirkhope actually was in the Baltimore area. Mm-hmm. Sadly, I did not know that until he moved. That made me sad.
Hindsight, always 2020, right?
I know, but he's going to be at MAGFest, so it'll be okay.
Yeah. Oh, MAGFest is an absolute blast. Is this going to be your first time?
No, this is, 13, 14, 15. I think it's like my 4th or 5th time.
Oh, nice. Awesome.
So, I mean, I go there all the time because it's like the biggest thing we have on the East Coast, and it's
definitely
pretty huge.
Yeah, if you like video games and video game music, this place is like heaven for like 2 or 3 days outside of D.C.
And it's very open. If you're used to things like PAX, you'll be shocked at what MAGFest is like because it's less of a business endeavor. It almost, even if you're like an attendee, it feels almost like a business endeavor. Whereas MAGFest is like even the guys on the board say it's literally just a place to chill for a few days.
Yeah, really. Like there's people in cosplay and you're at a big hotel like with normal people who are just looking around like, what is with all this cosplay and people dressed up as, Tron Bomb and Mega Man and.
Yeah,
there's a 24-hour arcade. Like, it is just paradise for 48 hours.
Yeah, and it's really funny when you mentioned like the normal people because I remember because I guess Guardians of the Galaxy came out some year, and then there was a dude dressed up as like Groot, like a legit like a legit costume, and like there were so many little kids like, oh my god, it's Groot! Like it's like Disneyland or something.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. Especially because they do it like in a winter time, so that large hotel has like large icicles inside like their big auditorium. So yeah, it's a cool looking area.
They have like a big thing during Christmas time, and a lot of it just kind of leaks into the following months. So it's because yep. I've been to that hotel before. I'd even gone to MAGFest, and it's kind of amazing.
Yeah, it's like on its own little like remote island, right?
Yeah, it's like a
harbor.
It's like a good biodome.
Yeah, exactly. There's like a bunch of little places to eat there and restaurants. There's decent nightlife.
And it's actually good. It's not just like, I mean, because you can think about like any sort of like usual like centers like that, and usually it's just out of obligation. But this is, it seems like people actually run things at that place.
Yeah, I know. And it's like consistently busy. So yeah, if you like video games and music, that is the place to go.
Oh yeah, now I have a panel there. I don't know when it is, but I have a panel there. I actually got.
Yeah, I saw on your Twitter before you got approved for it.
Yeah, I was surprised actually because I know there's a lot of popular stuff.
Hmm. What is the topic for your panel?
It's going to be SteamOS and Linux game development. So
awesome.
It's going to be very general. Well, not terribly general because I know there's going to be like 99% of the audience is going to be Unity devs. So
yep. Right.
I can't be. It's not going to be like Ryan Gordon's talks where he's used to like Unreal guys who are doing like inline assembly and stuff.
Yep.
Whereas mine is like, look, you need to know that the file system's case sensitive and that you shouldn't call the GLs thousands of times.
Yeah. Like, so back to the basics, fellas. Back to the basics.
Yeah. And so I was thinking about doing it a little bit more FNA centric, but then in doing that, I realized that I made the process way too streamlined. So that would be a 5-minute talk.
Right. Well, that's a good thing. But I mean, you also have to like appeal to the audience who's going to be there too, right?
Yeah, and it'll be interesting. I don't know how big that crowd's going to be, but depends because the SteamOS reaction has been open, but the actual sort of usage of it, I actually am not 100% sure. It's definitely I noticed a spike in people actually using it once the machines actually came out, but
right.
I'm interested in seeing what developers think of it because I haven't really gauged that yet
for SteamOS as a whole.
Yeah the controller is definitely mixed because people can even use that on Windows, and so
right.
Seeing what people have been able to do with that has been a lot of fun. And then SteamOS has been interesting so far. The only really developer centric thing is that somebody got Linux running on the PS4, and so for me that's like, if you want to compare Steam machine prices, hey, why don't we run it on the console you say is so cheap? And it'll run fine.
And what's crazy is like PS3 supported Linux out of the box. The Air Force bought like millions of dollars worth of PS3s because they really affordable like Linux boxes.
Several thousand, I think.
Yeah. And then Sony pulled support for it because I guess people were getting around DRM or some their protection layer somehow. I was like, oh, man.
Yeah, but the funny thing is now those really aren't required to have other OS because now every console ships with a web browser. So just start at the web browser and you're fine.
Yeah, I mean, hell, you look at on PS4, one of their lead architects for their graphics program is a gentleman named Don Olmsted. He gave a great talk at the Bay Area's JavaScript or web developer meetup about 2 years ago, where he explained like, hey, that storefront that you see on PS4 is actually all WebGL code that they took from the storefront on their website and then just brought it over. So they're banking quite a bit on that kind of thing too.
Yeah. And of course modders bank on it. Cause all you have to do is look at what version of like WebKit they're using and just be like,
that's
all right,
it.
We're just going to exploit that.
Simple enough, right?
I think that's how every console has been exploited so far. Like the Wii U's exploit was a web browser. PS4 is his web browser. And
wow.
It's not even a matter of being clever anymore. Well, then you just crash the sandbox.
So is this your full-time gig now?
Yes, it has been since 2000. It has been since basically 2012. Like once I started the summer job and that was full-time, I just kept doing it. So
that's perfect. You found like your own little, way to make a living while working on games. And that is, porting or making tools. So that's great to know that people, can make a viable living off doing something like this. That's awesome.
And it definitely is still viable because there's really only like four of us.
Yeah.
It's like four of us own the independent market completely. Four people.
Really?
Four.
And independent game sales are just going up at this point.
And we can pick and choose at this point because so we can just pick all the successful ones.
Yep.
So
do you think that there's like still an opening left behind, and that is like for mobile devices?
Not while it's closed as it is, because what makes it difficult, like for FNA, there's actually someone working on, someone actually got Fez running on an Android device, just using the Linux binaries, because the single assembly portability actually allowed them to do that. Yeah. Because it's, all you have to do is just add the necessary Android bits, and then it will just run, and it does not actually know or care where it actually is. And so it was interesting kind of fighting the Android stuff and then considering shipping for Android and shipping for iOS, and the fact that the toolkits, including the middlewares to get to the closed toolkits, are also closed. I live in a world where I have complete control over the pipeline. And so when I think about paying thousands of dollars just to compile, like that puts me off immediately.
Yeah, definitely. Especially with like, you know, how big open source has been for the last several years.
And the fact that people are recognizing that it's probably the best way to go about things.
Yeah, right. Because open source, lower barrier to entry, right, less friction, which you can then easily get more developers on board.
And the key part of more developers is more developers that aren't yours.
Right.
And so a lot of what made FNA successful is that I made FNA a service to the ecosystem first rather than the ecosystem serving FNA, which is what a lot of libraries do, where it's like, oh, we're going to take these libraries and these libraries, we're going to kludge them together, we're going to break them, fork them, and then just have this massive blob that nobody wants to take care of.
Right.
And so FNA, in contrast to that, like, we have no custom code for our libraries. There's not a single line. Every single thing that we've written has gone back to upstream at some point. And that was with the explicit understanding that these things that we are writing have to go to upstream, because if they're not good enough for upstream, it's probably crap and you shouldn't write it.
Right.
But if you don't do that, if you just do these things internally, you never have an external source to tell you that what you're writing is terrible.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like game development, where if you don't have someone actually playing it, everything you're writing is theoretical. You could spend 3 years making something that is great on paper. When you actually sit down and play it, you just want to kill yourself.
That's an interesting perspective on it. So do you think people should try things early and share them early as well?
Try them early and all the time. All the time.
Rather sanity checks throughout the day.
And it doesn't have to be test suites. Like, I've never done test-driven development. The way I do it is with data. Like, if I do something that I know is going to affect a certain game, if I do it wrong, I just run all those games on it. And it finds everything, and it gives you use cases too. So when you find something that's wrong, it's like, oh, it's like when I did some audio adjustments for FNA, I had went through Dust and Elysian Tail, which is one of my ports.
Yeah,
and
beautiful, beautiful artwork in that game, by the way.
Yeah, and that was a really fun one to work on, but I ended up breaking the sound horribly. Okay. And I never would have been able to find that had I not had a test unit for it.
Right.
Even though, whether it's more simple or more complicated, I don't really care what it is. I just need data that tells me that it's wrong, and then I can figure out whether it's complicated or not, and actually just fix the problem. Because
you're just having like guess in a black box and say, well, I don't know what it could be, and I can't see, so.
Especially when it's graphics and all you get is a black screen.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the data helps with that quite a bit. And how did I get there again?
You know what? Now I'm thinking about it. We started with a mobile, FNA mobile. Oh, yes. Talking about how it's like a closed environment, and that's the reason you're kind of staying away.
And iterating all the time. Like, one of the things that makes FNA usable is not just having other games to make sure that it still works, but that it also works in new environments. So there's a thing I do called speed porting.
Okay.
Where I literally take open source XNA games and I just port them as fast as I humanly can. And any single thing that makes it harder to make that happen in the most optimal time possible is a bug. Anything that gets in the way.
That's interesting.
So my current personal best time, I have gotten a Windows-only game running on Linux natively with FNA in 78 seconds.
Holy cow.
I'm trying to get it to sub 60, but 78 is my personal best, and I'm...
This is the kind of thing you need to start streaming and, you know, making YouTube playlists out of.
Possibly.
Like,
it'd be really funny.
Like, your own competitions, you know, for things like this.
I almost wanted to submit it to a GDQ, but...
Yeah, I was going to say, like, yeah, exactly. You do, you know, for charity or games done quick, something like that. You could start your own little category of porting, you know, applications.
And so, and the most important part about that is that it's all blind. So I have no idea what the game or the content looks like. So I have to do it as blindly as possible using nothing but FNA, and it and nothing can get in the way. And so if it takes 78 seconds because it sucks, then that's a problem. But I actually got to 78 seconds because it used to be like 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And I was like, no. This, like, I looked at the video. I'm like, why am I clicking on all of this? Like, why am I?
So you kind of recorded yourself, went back to look at how to improve your own performance.
And so that's when I was able to just say, okay, we need to statically link everything. It's one DLL. There's no autogen. There's no like project generation. It's just a DLL. And you link it once. It's, you can even include it as a CS project in your solution, and you just build. And there's no special anything, including content. Content shouldn't change. So it should just be like, take the Windows version and have it run without changing anything. Don't recompile. Yeah. You don't need a content pipeline. Content pipelines are a huge effort. And to be fair, credit to the Monogame team for making a content pipeline, because that's like 200,000 lines of code that I don't want to write. And so, you know, and that's what a lot of motivation for rewriting some of their content stuff, like with shaders. Like I spent 2 months reverse engineering and completely rewriting and documenting the effects framework format.
Yep.
Because 2 months of that means I never have to look at a shader again.
Right.
And so I just ship, and then people go, wait, what do you mean? You didn't, what did you build with? And I went, I didn't. I just recompiled the source. Yeah. And in some cases, you don't even need to recompile the source. As it turns out, there's a developer called, I'm butchering his name. It's Mike Macho. He's German. He turned 17 like last year.
And he's programming.
Not only is he programming, he's programming really well. He's actually like, he's the one who got Fez running on Android without the source.
Wow. Holy cow. And like, make you wonder like where he's even learning how half the stuff works.
With data.
Yeah.
As soon as I found out he was able to do that, I was like, take whatever you need. If you need examples from me, if you need like things about SDL2, if you need a contact for SDL2 support, I got that for you. And so now it's like,
he could be your greatest ally.
Yeah. And one of the things that he wrote as a means of getting more test data is he wrote a tool called XNA to FNA. And what it does is it takes an XNA binary, it reassembles it using reflection that link to relink it to FNA. And then it's possible for a game like that's written in XNA without even disassembling it to have it running on Linux natively. So I actually
took done with the assistance of a young kid.
Yeah, like this one kid was like, I got these like commercial XNA games running on Linux natively with my little tool.
Holy cow.
And like, yeah, I actually tried it myself. Like, I got Cthulhu Saves the World, like this huge exploit game. I got it running natively without doing anything.
Wow. Yes, I mean, you've quite the marketplace over here cornered. This is nice.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, and it's just like a fun technical thing. Like, hey,
I'm just learning and learning and learning every day.
And sidestep and breaking things. Because I'm definitely like a hacker modder type. So my approach to things is definitely I definitely like to take things apart in ways you're not supposed to, because that's where all the good data is.
Yeah, definitely. And try to like rebuild it in a way that suits your needs.
And it's I don't know. It's why I think that I've been able to do as well as I have, and it's why I think people who do things where modding is an encouraged thing, either by way of them explicitly saying modders are welcomed here, or modders are not welcomed, but we have terrible security. So by all means, but FNA is a really good example of a game that's open source, like an open source library, but I had modders in mind while making that.
Right.
Because like, you know, there's some things like you want to be able to develop with ES2. So just enable the environment variable, and then you can just run any FNA game with ES, even though we didn't design it for that.
Oh, so you're trying to make it like largely as modular as possible for developers of the future.
Pretty much. Like, and the way FNA platforms work is you add files and then you modify one file and it's done.
Ah, okay. And I'm noticing even like you have SDL2 Sharp, which is great, because I started doing work with SDL2 a couple weeks ago. That ran into some roadblocks immediately because I guess the C++ compiler changed in Visual Studio 2015 from 2013. But this is cool that you know, people can essentially have SDL2 but in C#. And I'm trying to understand, like, why would someone even do this? But you see, this wrapper was written to be used with FNA's platform support.
Yes.
So this is great because now people don't need to use something like C++, which can be very like hitting a wall when it terms of learning a programming language. And, you know, obviously SDL2 is a pure port of the C headers, so I don't need to learn C either.
Yeah, so you don't need to learn a new API. Like, you can just use the documentation that's already there, and you already know what to do. Like, this is another example of data-driven but still serving the ecosystem, where I could have just written some bindings in FNA internally and just left it there, but I knew that SDL2 was something that people were going to want elsewhere, and I wanted it to be a place where people, if there's something wrong with the SDL2 bindings, someone else who's not even using FNA can figure out what that problem is, and then that can go back. So it's very much designed in a way where if there's anything that someone else can use other than me, I got to get it out there on its own.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to write my own effect subsystem for FNA. I wrote it into Mojo Shader. And the funny thing is, literally like 3 months after I shipped that for the first time, I had another game that was not XNA that needed that effect work. So I was already done.
Perfect. Yeah, you're like one step ahead of the game.
And so recognizing the value of the ecosystem as a whole can really, really save you some time.
Yeah.
Because even if you don't think it's anybody else, it's probably going to be you.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So you're spending time up front to save yourself time later on.
Yeah. It, like, avoiding the have to invent everything here and has to be ours is hugely detrimental thing to get out of.
Yeah. So one final question before we get out of here. How do you pronounce this pseudonym or name? And where did that come from?
The thing is, I didn't prepare a made-up backstory, because that's kind of a joke, because I always make up a new one.
Yeah.
But the correct pronunciation, if I could pronounce that phrase correctly, is flibbitijibibbo.
Flibbitijibibbo.
Or flibbit. This is an informal conversation.
Seen flibbit several times.
Most people call me flibbit. But the way I teach people is that it's three triple eighth notes and two eighth notes.
So it's a musical thing.
So it's like flibbitijibibbo, if you think of that in one measure of music.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, because every time I see it, even your email is that@flibbitijibibbo.com. It's like, okay. And like trying to look at this, I'm like, how many I's and L's do I have in this? I don't even know.
It should be seven consonants and six vowels, and only one of them is not an I.
Yeah.
I kind of took that apart after the fact.
Yeah, I guess. This is great.
I'm really good about names.
The way I wrap up every show is I ask the current guest, that's you, a question that the previous guest had left for you. Mm-hmm. And then I would like for you to follow up immediately after with a question of your own for the next guest, who I know who this person will be, but I have not told you. So you ready?
Yeah.
Okay, so last time it was Kevin Jaguer. He had asked, as mobile development has become more popular among gamers and developers alike, what impact has that had on the console and PC markets?
There are some gameplay aspects that have definitely changed. As soon as free-to-play was considered viable, whether or not it's actually viable, people went, okay, let's try that. Hasn't really worked, because I think the mindset of people is definitely different, because a lot of mobile people just thought that's how games worked, whereas you have people who are like, I'm willing to spend a lot of money on one game. Just let me do it up front.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of resistance in that aspect. As far as technical, I don't really know, because unfortunately the opportunity to have an open platform was pretty much completely lost. So it's pretty much the same as the consoles, where it's like everything is... Sure, the API SDK is out there, but, you know, stupid app signing and like all these like steps that, again, like I think about doing a speed port, all this app signing and all this license validation is like... It is a disrespect to a developer and the customer that time has to be spent on that instead of making a product that doesn't suck. Yeah. Like, it's just rude. It just, you don't talk about like business models, like just out of pure politeness. It is just, it's a real shame that no open platform has been able to make it such that you're not doing stupid, stupid things just to get it to boot.
Yeah, it's like busy business work instead of getting down to the programming aspect of it.
And so, and like, Android's almost close, but you basically just have to ship like unsigned binaries, which admittedly, people who use Android generally are smart enough to be able to be like, look, I'll just hit that tick box and I'll deal with it.
Right.
But, you know, it's still a lot of steps, and there is a part of me that's like, I wish I could just have C and not these Java entry points, but that's a different story. So, as far as the gameplay is concerned, free-to-play definitely kind of bled its way into the business. I don't know if that will last for a while, because as more instances of that keep failing at really, really large scales, MMOs are a really good example of this.
Yeah.
That may fall to the wayside, and that may actually get people to just go to mobile where that works, because it's
right.
You can just have that whale hunting model. I don't know.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens, right?
Yeah.
It's like, make it free, and then, you know, have in-game transactions and currency, and for 99% of your players, they're not spending anything, but you have those few whales who are spending all of the money, and that's what's keeping you afloat.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know. Like, the games business is no stranger to ethically questionable behavior, but that was one where it'd be very difficult for me to work on a free-to-play game. It'd be hard for me to talk about that, like, as I do with the work that I do now, where, like, I have, like, I talk about it with people who don't even care. Like, it just, like, a flip switches on my head. Like, I know that I'm being annoying, but I just have to have, like, someone like my fiance, like, drag me out.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could do that with something that I knew who had really, really awful things behind it.
Yeah. I'm, like, just manipulating the way you're playing and things.
To the detriment of the fun.
Yeah, and it's not to say that all free-to-play is bad, because it's not. But the issue is that very, very few developers have implemented it in a way to keep the gameplay solid and fun. And essentially, people are having to re-engineer a lot of the games today so they can fit this free-to-play model, which many of us didn't grow up with, and just kind of makes you uncomfortable.
And that's the problem, is that it's the model and the product that uses it often don't match at all.
Right.
Like, because the problem that what makes it so, what led it to such an unethical behavior is not that, like, people just started off making something new for it and that's just how it ended up, but I think it's just that someone actually made a free to play game that's interesting. Sure, I'm sure there is one out there, but then you have games that don't, like, I just imagine, like, Dark Souls. Like, that's a game everybody likes still, right?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I can't get into that, or Bloodborne, but that's not even over there.
I just imagine that with microtransactions.
Yeah. Oh, like, oh, do you want to revive right where you are now, or keep your souls? I could easily see that. To each their own. I mean, but on the flip side, in terms of, like, DLC and things, I guess DLC is a whole different aspect. But
DLC is, like, the only thing that's in that's similar is that. Is like stuff that's designed to be DLC. That's a little weird. But, like, if you think of, like, you know,
expansion
Smash Brothers.
Expansion packs for Quake in the 90s.
Right? Oh, yeah, expansion packs. It.
Yeah.
Or, like, I think even Smash Brothers had a really good model, too, where it's, like, they aren't really that big of changes. Well, I guess characters are big changes in, like, fighting-type games. But, like, when you consider the fact that those characters definitely take a while to work on, they probably...
Absolutely.
They probably had it in the drawing board somewhere, but there's no way... that they had all of those characters at launch.
Yeah, like, creating content is a lot more of a process than I think most people give developers credit for.
Yeah, and it's the simplicity with which content can be chopped up and sold as DLC, you can give them some rope for that, but it's, you have to find ways in kind of presenting DLC to show that it's supposed to be something plus one as opposed to something to get to zero. As far as, like, the net worth is at.
Yep, exactly. So do you have a question for the next developer who comes in the show?
The one that I always think is interesting, because it always makes developers extremely nervous, is when it comes to the stuff that you write, what you've written, and how long you expect it to be played, given that you probably think that your own game is valuable because you're presumably trying to sell it, how do you intend to preserve that for the next 50 years?
So I would break this down to, how would you intend to preserve the value of your product or your game?
How do you intend to preserve it? Not just the value, but the fact that people probably want to play it, and that's not going to be possible in 5 years with the binary you have today, even on the PC. Because one of the, like, as an example, the reason FNA is a preservation tool, not just as a porting tool, is because a large number of contracts that I receive are FNA ports on Windows. Because XNA has a very strange habit of not working on Windows 8 and apparently Windows 10 as well. So now I get people who are like, hey, this Linux Mac version, does it work for Windows 2? And I'm like, just rebuild it. And they run it, and the customer comes to me and says, thank you so much for making the Windows version work. And I'm like,
yeah,
hello, this is what preservation is all about. And
yeah,
so,
definitely.
You know, especially when you're on something like Unity, you better hope that they either open source that or stick around for the next forever, because you're going to see another XNA situation.
Well, then what are you doing?
And so, like, think about the old games, like Doom.
Yep.
The reason we still play Doom isn't just because it's awesome, but because you can run that thing everywhere.
Hell, like, I mean, you look at the ports. Someone open sourced the Jaguar version, I think maybe a couple years ago.
In the 3DO Jaguar version.
What was it?
In a 3DO version, too.
Oh, 3DO. I don't know why I thought the Jaguar. But, like, I mean, think about where that game has gone. 3DO, 32X, PC, Super NES, Mac. Like, that thing has
fridge.
Been everywhere. Yeah, yeah. It'll be, my fridge will be tweeting Doom, you know, to my microwave in the very near future.
Yeah, and so, and the reason, just the act of open sourcing the game, even after it was long after it's done with sales, means that thing is going to be around forever.
Right.
And there are tons of games that were as good or possibly even better than Doom that nobody knows about.
And now people can learn from this and carry on. And it's kind of one of those things that will live on forever, you know, largely because of how well something like that was produced.
Yeah. And so I think when you ask, when you actually, because people always think like, oh, my game will be fine and it'll work. But I think if you actually sit down with a developer and say, are you actually preserving it, or do you have a plan?
Right.
And the room gets real quiet every time.
It's kind of like they're thinking right now and that's it.
Yeah.
So we'll see how it plays out in the future.
Yeah.
Well, Ethan, thank you very much for joining me. It was a great time. Like I said, this was definitely the longest show I've had so far, and by far the most technical. So I love having talks like this, because it's not all the time I get to have an opportunity to talk with people who go so low level in the code. So I'm glad we finally had a chance to have a chat about this.
Yeah.
So in the future, where can people find you and some of your work, whether a Twitter handle or a website? Like, where would you like to direct people to find more about what you're doing?
Twitter's the easiest, because that sort of ends up being a funnel to everything else. I do have like a website. All of my handles on Twitter, Google+, my own website is the alias FlibidageofByBo, unfortunately. So you're going to probably have to look at the notes below this recording to see. But,
or if they look up, you know, Ethan Lee FNA, you're a very easy person to find.
Yeah, Ethan Lee FNA or Ethan Lee Linux or things like that. Sometimes you may find me via other means. Like, I think if you Google like Fez Friday 1.12, you might find me, because I've actually done a lot of writing about the next update we're doing to Fez, or the next update I did for V, and I wrote like weekly things like that.
The third thing that pops up. Ah, yeah.
So,
very
things
cool.
Like that.
Oh, yeah. Actually, in the bottom of here, I see Fez 1.12 testing. Speed runs, too. Someone's trying to speed run the game. Who knows?
We actually got speedrunners to test builds of 1.12, and it's actually been going really well. So
that's cool.
It was really fun seeing the speedrun live too. I wanted 1.12 to be for GDQ, but oh well.
Yeah, that's always next year, right? Or the next time they do it.
Oh, definitely.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for joining. I appreciate it.
Yeah, man.
All right, until the next time.
See ya.